Welcome to the Essentials of Noetic Sciences series. I'm Lindsay King, and tonight our host is ION Senior Scientist Dean Radin, and he will introduce his guest, Jim Tucker. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you, Lindsay, and welcome, Jim. Jim Tucker is our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Since this program is a part of the Essentials of the Noetic Sciences, then it's very appropriate that we're speaking to Jim. Jim is a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia. He works at the Department of Perceptual Studies, which is a unit of the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. This is a research unit that was started in 1967 by the psychiatrist Ian Stevenson, who is probably best known for his work on studying reincarnation in children. And Jim has been following this work and continuing the work of Ian Stevenson. His most recent book on this topic is called Life Before Life, A Scientific Investigation of Children's Memories of Previous Lives. And one of the differences between what Ian Stevenson did and what Jim is doing is writing these stories, which many of which are very compelling, in a way which is also engaging and compelling to read. So Ian was a brilliant scientist, but tended to write up the case studies in a somewhat dry scientific way. And in some respects, that's a pity from a public's point of view, because the stories are really mind-boggling when you think about it. And Jim has the talent to bring that excitement back into the story. So the topic tonight, then, I'll just read from the plan, that Dr. Tucker challenges the notion that consciousness is only the result of a functioning brain. He suggests that consciousness can be considered separately from the brain, which provides a basis for claims of reincarnation. He also discusses the usual objections to reincarnation, such as that there's only a few persons who actually claim to remember a past life, or that memory is very fragile and subject to confabulation, or that the population explosion somehow would not make reincarnation plausible, or that the connection between the mind and body are so well understood, some people say, that there's no room for reincarnation, or that there might be fraud and lots of other explanations. Well, he has good explanations and counters to those kinds of criticisms, and so I think we might begin, Jim, with telling how you became involved in this unusual and yet very compelling area of research.
Yeah, well, it's work that was going on long before I did become involved. And you mentioned that Ian started our Division 67, but he had actually started this work in 1961, was when he took his first trip to study these cases. And I'll start with the way the work came about and then how I got interested much later. Ian was a psychiatrist with quite a successful academic career to that point. He had become chairman of the Department of Psychiatry here at UVA while he was still in his late 30s, so he was doing quite well. But he'd always had an interest in parapsychology and in the question about survival after death. And there was he wrote up an article. He, over the years, had collected 44 cases of people reporting memories of previous lives from various sources like newspapers or magazines or journals. When he pulled them all together, he found that there were a lot of similarities in the cases, including the fact that many of the examples were very young children who were reporting these memories. So he wondered in the article if current cases could still be found of children talking like this. Well, soon after that, he heard about some cases, and so in 1961, he took his first trip to India. By the time he went, he'd heard about 5 cases, and then once he got to India for a month, he found 25, and he discovered that this thing was much more common than anyone had ever known before, and became more and more interested eventually stepping down as chairman, forming this division so that he could work on these cases full time. So he did this for several decades, published numerous academic books and articles and so forth. I actually trained here in psychiatry in the late 80s, early 90s, and heard about Ian's work, but at the time I wasn't particularly intrigued by it, not enough to meet him or anything. But then after my training, I went into private practice doing psychiatry as well as child psychiatry. And when I got remarried, my wife was very intrigued by things like reincarnation or psychics and various things that I had never really given much thought to. Because of her interest, it got me curious, so I was doing a lot of reading and happened to be reading one of Ian's books when we saw that his division had gotten a new grant to study the effects that near-death experiences have on the lives of people who have them. So I called them up just looking for sort of a hobby, in addition to my private practice, a hobby to do something that might be interesting. So I called to volunteer some time if they needed help interviewing patients. So I started coming just an hour a week for like a couple of years. But then eventually Ian asked me if I would be interested in taking a trip to Asia with one of our colleagues to study some of these cases. And I was very interested. And then after that came on half-time, and then in 2000 came on full-time. And I've been doing it ever since. I spent about half my time actually still doing clinical work, but the other half is involved in this very interesting phenomenon of very young children who talk about previous lives.
And so given your involvement for so many years now, I'm guessing that you must find something that is continually compelling in the stories that you hear, otherwise you wouldn't have persisted with it. So what can you say then about either your first trip or subsequent trips studying these cases that gave you the sense that there's something really real going on here and not just one of the usual critiques?
Well, the phenomenon certainly has some very impressive sort of black and white things on paper, because some of these children make statements that turn out to be remarkably accurate for somebody who died before they were born. Some of the kids will talk about being deceased family members, but others will describe being strangers in other locations, and if they give enough details like the name of that location, then people have often gone there and found that, in fact, somebody had lived and died who matched the details that the child gave. And some of them, the people are nearby, so you wonder, well, could they have overheard the information or whatever, but there are others where they're quite some distance away. And so it becomes, again, just black and white on paper, they become very impressive cases. But in studying them myself, I've also been impressed by the emotional component of this, that it is clear that for many of these kids, it's certainly not just a game of make-believe or fun for them. I mean, this is very important to them, very meaningful. Some of the kids will cry on a daily basis to be taken to who they say is their real family. They'll talk about the people they missed. And I recently studied an American case, which is quite interesting. But the mother had heard about this phenomenon, and she said that years ago she had thought it would be neat to have a child who had these memories. But then once her child had them, she discovered it was not neat at all, because it was so traumatic for the child to talk about these people and places that he missed.
Are you talking about the American case?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's crying every night about the life that he used to have, and she's trying to comfort him, and it just becomes sort of overwhelming for both of them. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting case that hopefully the world would learn more about, because it's been filmed for a documentary. It sort of by happenstance, they got in filming me at the ground floor of this case. That child made a lot of very, very interesting statements that panned out for somebody.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about this case?
Yeah, well, to just to give you the brief overview, and there are other American cases that are just as strong, but this child talked about a life in Hollywood, which, of course, might sound like it's just kind of a fantasy.
How old was the child?
Child at that point was four.
Uh-huh.
And gave a lot of details about having had a big swimming pool and dancing on stage, and how after he had been an actor, then he had become an agent, and he had traveled around the world on a big boat, and on and on with again, what sounded like it might be fantasy. Well, his mom, trying to get more specific memories, got some old Hollywood, old movie books for him to look through to see if they would see places that would sort of stir his memory more. Well, they came across a picture of an old George Raft movie, and he looks at it and says, "Oh, that's a movie I made with George." And then he points to a man in the picture and says, "That was me, Mom. That's who I was." Well, it turned out that the guy he pointed to, sort of fortunately or unfortunately, was an extra who had no lines in the movie. So it became quite a process to try to identify who the heck that person was. But it turned out that, and for people, younger people who may not know who George Raft is, he made movies back in the 30s. So anyway, this extra turned out to be a guy who, in fact, had been a dancer on stage before going to Hollywood to be an actor. He did eventually have a big house and a swimming pool, and he, in fact, did become an agent, had quite a successful agency, did travel the world on big buddies on Queen Elizabeth. We got pictures of him on Queen Elizabeth. And a lot of other details that panned out for this one guy. And often the criticism of these cases, even when you have kids who seem to be remembering a lot of specific details, people will say, well, it's just sort of coincidence that there's so many people who've lived and died that you can find someone whose life matched. Well, in this case, there is this one guy in the picture whose life either was going to fit what the kid said or wouldn't. And in this case, it turned out that many of the details, not all, but many of the details that the child gave did turn out to be accurate for this one guy.
Hmm. And what do you do, or how do you interpret the things that the child said that did not match? Or was it a case where you couldn't confirm that it was...
Well, there were a lot of things that couldn't be confirmed because not a lot of people are still around who knew him, obviously. Mm-hmm. We were able to talk to a daughter. She was quite young when he died, but I mean, she knew the essentials of his life. So there were a lot of details, little things that couldn't be, may or may not have been true. But then, as in most of the cases, the child said some things that were simply incorrect. Now... Yeah, if any of us talk about our early childhoods, we may well come up with things that are incorrect just for this life. So maybe we shouldn't expect kids to have 100% accuracy. But this kid in particular also seems, and this may be too much for people to swallow, but he also seems to have some psychic abilities. He's come up with some specific predictions about people. The one that stands out in my mind was that he said told his grandmother she was going to get chicken pox, and then a couple of weeks later she had an outbreak of shingles. So it may be that he can access material from a variety of places beyond just this one person's life. So he's certainly connected emotionally to this one life, but then there are other details that, perhaps it's just is wrong, or it's just kind of fantasy that he imagined. But some of it may also be him just picking up on other things separate from the one guy who lived and died.
Mm. Yeah, it's unfortunate that being psychic and the concept of reincarnation overlap, because it makes it more difficult to know, to interpret the information that's coming out.
Well, so that's right. And that's been one of the, not exactly criticisms, but one of the interpretations of some of these cases. There are some arguments against it purely being psychic material. For one thing, it's certainly not the child's experience. I mean, they are reporting not just information, but previous experiences from one person's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, most of the children do not show any psychic abilities other than all these details about one specific person. So it doesn't disprove it. It could be psychic, super psi or whatever you want to call it, psychic kind of stuff. But I think it does make it more questionable. Certainly on the face of it, the cases appear to be hard to remember in their life.
So if you, as a child psychiatrist, you deal a lot with children, obviously. With children of that age, if you were to ask them to make up a story that would match what, as best they could make up, a similar kind of story that they're reincarnated, however they would understand that, is it possible to tell by their emotional response or something else when a child is making it up versus these kinds of stories that appear to be genuine?
Well, certainly the parents often say that they can tell a difference, that this is not the same thing as sort of the sing-songy kind of make-believe type stories that kids are making up, that this is much more serious and more matter-of-fact. And again, at times can be much more emotional. Now, you know, we don't have lie detectors that see if a four-year-old is telling the truth or not. But the parents say that there's certainly a difference between those kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's sort of like people will say with near-death experiences, where you have to look at the effect that it has on someone. And certainly these apparent memories can have quite an emotional effect on the child who's having them.
Right. So given that there are cases, or I guess originally it must have been focused on India because of the cultural support for those ideas, but I guess there are cases in every country in the world.
Every country that anyone has looked at for, cases have been found. So all the continents except Antarctica, where no one has looked as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And they're certainly easiest to find in cultures with a belief in reincarnation. So bunches of cases from India, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, places like that. But they are certainly found in cultures without a general belief in reincarnation, such as the U.S. I mean, especially now with, you know, the Internet, where people can find us easily. We hear from parents all the time whose kids are reporting these things. Now, some of the cases are a lot stronger than others, have a lot more details than others, but certainly this phenomenon goes beyond places with a belief in reincarnation because they happen here. And even, I mean, most of the families that report these things to us say they did not have a belief in reincarnation before the children start saying these things. So it happens in a country and in a family without a specific belief in reincarnation.
Right. And so what has been learned about the demographics of where the reincarnation came from? I'm thinking specifically of the geographic location. So, for example, I don't know of any cases from the India population where someone reported a previous life in another country.
Well, are some, but they usually have a connection with that country. So, for instance, in India, there were what Ian called the blonde bomber cases. So there were kids that are talking about having been, say, a British pilot who was killed during World War II or something like that. He found a couple of dozen cases in Burma, Burmese children, saying that they had been Japanese soldiers who had been killed in Burma during World War II. And the Japanese were despised in Burma. You know, pretty rough things happened. And so certainly it's hard to imagine that the parents certainly weren't egging them on to say that, that's for sure. And those kids would show, a lot of them show sort of Japanese kinds of inclinations. So, for instance, they might complain about the spicy Burmese food and ask to eat raw fish instead, that sort of thing. And the Burmese have a particular outfit that the men wear, essentially, it's a skirt. And whereas many of these kids will refuse to wear those and want to wear pants instead. So those cases are nice when they do happen because it's sometimes easier to see the behavioral parts of these cases where there is a international distinction. But you're right, it's unusual, it's very unusual for a child to talk about a life in another country with no connection to where he or she was born.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say we may not pursue those cases. If you're studying a child, say, in Thailand who says, well, I used to live in Africa, well, there's not a whole lot you can do to research that as far as tracking it down, unless the kid gets very specific about details. And
mm-hmm.
we do get some American reports like that, and there's really nothing we can
Reports from American kids who believe that they formerly were in Africa?
And sometimes, there'll be some behavioral things that perhaps are linked. But the other thing to keep in mind is that our cases tend to be very recent previous lives. The median interval between the death of the previous person and the birth of the child is only 16 months. So we're talking about very recent lives. So if these are cases of reincarnation, then there are ones where the person came back very quickly and seemingly most of the time came back fairly close by. Now, I mean, we've got exceptions like the kid I was just talking about where 50 years between them. But it's much more common for them to be more recent. And usually, unfinished business is sort of a term, of course, that's subjective. But a lot of these cases do seem to involve unfinished business, and about 70% of them will involve a death by unnatural means, usually a violent death. And then a lot of them involve young people, too, children or very young adults. So there may have been, again, if you're going to speculate about how the reincarnation part works, there may have been a real impetus to come, or maybe they're stuck where they are and they have to come back quickly, but for whatever reason, they seem to come back quickly, come back pretty nearby. But they also come back with intact memories, which, if reincarnation does happen to other people, don't come back with those. So these cases may not generalize to the rest of the population. So the fact that 95%, I'm making that figure up, but the vast majority of kids talk about a life in the same country would not mean that other people necessarily would have the same constraints.
But I think it does imply that if it's true for a couple of kids, in the cases, you take it face value, then it's probably true for everyone, whether we remember it or not.
Well, I sort of go back and forth on that, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think it certainly these cases, on the face of it, obviously, but even, I mean, these cases provide evidence that there can be this survival after a death. But I don't think they necessarily require, maybe not even imply, that it has to be a survival in this same world that we're in now. I mean, it shows that it can happen, but if our world is essentially created out of consciousness, as I believe, then I don't see any reason why other worlds couldn't be created out of consciousness also. So the consciousness that each of us has would continue in some fashion, but not necessarily back in this world.
When you said that you believe that the world made of consciousness or constructed?
Not necessarily made of it, but it grows out of consciousness.
Describe that in a little more detail.
Well, it gets into quantum physics, which, of course, I confess I don't have a full understanding now. Of course, no one else
does
either. But
nobody does, yeah.
I don't know how much detail to go into for people listening or before I lose my own train of thought, but the idea that observation is necessary for wave function collapse, or basically that events don't occur until they are observed, and that this is true not just for on the quantum level, not just for current events, but for things in the past too, that the past has to be observed before it comes into reality. So, they say that there are as many interpretations of quantum theory as are a quantum physicist. But I think the way I interpret that is that if observation is necessary for physical events to exist, then something has to be doing the observing. And I think a case can be made, and people like Henry Stapp have more or less made it, that consciousness is necessary for wave function collapse or for events to occur.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that events from the past or that things don't exist until they're observed is very similar to, the only similarity I can really think of is to the dream world, where our dreams at night, people don't exist in that world until we observe them. And it more or less seems like it's the same in our physical universe, that things don't really exist until they are observed. So just like our nighttime dreams are creations of our mind, an argument, I think, can be a pretty strong argument, can be made that the physical world may well be a creation of mind as well.
Not necessarily personal mind, but something larger than or something like that?
Well, that's a question. I mean, are our individual minds, are they, the William James idea that basically the consciousness flows through them, but the mind, our brains don't create them, the consciousness that flows through them. So if this beam of consciousness that sort of each of us serve as portals for, do they all come from one source or not? And, of course, there's no way to know that for sure. But, sort of like another analogy is, are we all islands where underneath the surface we're all connected, even though we appear to be all separate?
Mm-hmm. Was this idea that you have something that you had before you started doing this research, or did it develop as a result of trying to think of how to understand these phenomena?
Well, I certainly didn't have it before I got involved in this work, but getting involved in this work has made me curious about a lot of things, and also the conferences that I've been to at Esalen, where there's a lot of mind expanding kind of material that people are talking about. So it certainly got me intrigued in all this. I mean, before this work, so before 10 years ago, I knew almost nothing about quantum physics, and now I guess I know just a little bit, enough to have an opinion. But the more that you look at the various aspects in sort of parapsychology as far as near-death experiences or our cases or mediumistic work or apparitions, I mean, you look at all that and it sure looks like that there can be consciousness that can survive separate from the physical container that it was in, meaning the body and the brain. So then you have to sort of with an explanation for that.
Mm-hmm. When was it that the cases of marks on the body corresponding with the previous life, when did those cases come about, and do those occur in children as well?
They do, because they're birthmarks. And these are ones that they are birthmarks or birth defects that match wounds, usually the fatal wound, on the body of the previous person. And Ian, being a medical man, and with a particular interest actually in psychosomatic medicine before all of this work came about, he was quite intrigued by this connection between the mental and the physical. So when he started hearing about these cases back in the 60s, he became very interested in them. And eventually he intended to be a little obsessive, and it took him about 20 years to finally write out these cases. But he eventually published a 2,000-page magnum opus called Reincarnation and Biology, where he talks about over 200 of these cases. And a lot of them are not just sort of the usual blemish or birthmark that a lot of people have, but they can be, some of them, quite fairly horrific as far as missing limbs or gnarled fingers or things like that, but also distinctive things like cases where the previous person was shot and killed and the child is born with both a small round entrance wound in the right place and a larger, more irregularly shaped exit wound in the right place. So you get some very distinctive birthmarks or frank birth defects that these kids are born with. And there are ones that match the statements that the child makes about the previous person. And when he could, Ian would get autopsy reports to confirm the match. Often in these Asian villages, those weren't available, but he would get eyewitness reports and try to determine just how well the marks matched the wounds that the previous person suffered.
So if we take those cases at face value, what does that? How do we begin to even interpret what the body-mind connection means? I mean, it makes the body extremely fluid in terms of how it's going to be constructed, I guess.
Yes. I mean, the way I mean, when I first got involved in this work, I had trouble swallowing this idea that how would a wound on a previous person, even if you believe in survival, how would a wound on a previous person then show up as a birthmark on the baby? But the way I think of it now is that we know from other work that there are times where mental images can have very specific effects on the body. So, for instance, stigmata cases, or there are some hypnosis cases where there's a famous case, which you're probably aware of, where a guy, actually this is not hypnosis, but a guy relived a traumatic event in which his arms had been tied up, and he developed what sure looked like rope marks on his arm. So there are times where you get these very specific effects on the body from mental images. Well, if the consciousness that experiences being shot or whatever it is survives, then it may carry those mental images with it to a developing fetus. And a developing fetus may be a particularly susceptible physical body that could then be affected by those mental images, but then when the child is born, the birthmarks come with them.
I guess that makes sense. Does this, I mean, as best, as good a sense as any, I suppose. Is it also the case that children who report previous lives retain something like talent that the previous person may have had, musical or dance or some other thing which is identifiable as talent?
Yes, of course, that tends to be more subjective. I mean, they don't tend to be child prodigies. There is a question, of course, where child prodigies get their abilities, but I'm not aware of any cases where a Mozart-like prodigy also had past life memories. Mm. And with our cases, they don't tend to be prodigies like that, but they tend to pick up things more quickly. So they can learn a musical instrument to play it more quickly than their peers, or learn another language more quickly than their peers. There are a few cases where kids seem to actually speak a language they haven't learned. Sometimes those, unfortunately, there's no one around them who would know if it would match the language. Say, like in Burma, there might be no one who could speak Japanese to know if those kids were really speaking it. But there have been a few cases where pretty decent documentation that in fact, the kids spoke an unknown language. So anyway, the skills can come, but not in full force. So, you know, if you don't play basketball for 40 years and you take it up again, well, you can still shoot better than if you'd never shot, but it's going to take a lot of practice to get good at it again.
Right. So given that we're coming up next year in 50 years since Ian started his research, what's on the horizon? What's next other than continuing to collect more and more compelling cases?
Well, one thing that I've been trying to do and recently have had more success with is trying to collect American cases, because I think it's too easy for people to dismiss the Asian ones. It's just been a cultural phenomenon. Even though it's clear, it's more complicated than that. And in fact, a lot of the Asian parents try to get the kids to stop talking about the stuff, even if they believe in reincarnation. But I do think that American cases can be more, that can be harder to ignore, I guess is the way to put it. The other thing that we're working on is we have created a computer database, and for each of our cases, we code them on 200 variables and then put them into the database. And unfortunately, 200 variables takes a lot of time to code. So this is a multi-year study, but we've got about 1,800 of them now in the database out of a total of 2,500 that have been studied. And with that sort of database, then you can look at patterns in cases that you can't really see on an individual case level. Mm-hmm. So there are, I think, a lot of interesting things that we will be able to learn. We're already looking at, but once we get the whole collection in, then it'll be basically any area of the cases that intrigues us, we can run stats on and see if the patterns pan out the way we think they would or not.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we've looked at is a lot of people say, well, the over-enthusiastic parents sort of create the cases. Well, we've looked at whether we code for the initial reaction of the parents to the cases, and we can look and see how well does that correspond to how strong the cases are. And in fact, we see it doesn't correspond at all. So having parents who are enthusiastic about the cases doesn't sort of artificially make them stronger than they actually were.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're 40 minutes past the hour, so I think we'll turn it back to Lindsay, and we can open up and see what the listening audience has to say.
Okay, thank you, Dean. And now's your chance to ask questions. So if you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Jim Tucker, or host Dean Radin, please press 1 on your keypad now. And we ask that you press 1 two or three times just to make sure it sticks, so to speak, because sometimes the technology works better than others. And while we're waiting for someone to push 1, I will read one of the questions that was emailed into us. This one comes from Marie. Is there a possibility that remembering and or enacting past life experiences are manifestations of an individual's enhanced ability to tap into or be a receiver or sender of energy in the cosmic consciousness?
Well, that's a big question. It's sort of hard to answer specifically. I think with the vast majority of our cases, these kids stop talking about these things around the age of 5, 6, or 7. So to sort of look at that question, it may be that very young children have a greater ability to tap into this than we do. You know, sort of the downside of learning to function well in this world may be having to give up some of that. Now, with the adults, we actually are fairly skeptical about hypnotic regression. I mean, I think there probably are cases of legitimate memories that come out of them, but hypnosis, while it can be quite powerful, can also be very unreliable. So, and it's hard to know when someone has apparent memories under hypnosis whether those are actually past life memories or just their mind kind of filling in the blank with fantasy material. So accessing past life memories through hypnosis, to me, wouldn't necessarily say a whole lot about anything other than perhaps sort of an active imagination or being very hypnotizable. But with the kids, they don't tend to be sort of little mystics for the most part. It's sort of, again, addressing that question, but there is something about that very early part of life where they seem to be able to connect to something.
Okay.
I have a follow-up to that, a question. These kinds of cases can be studied and verified, which is what provides the evidence that makes it scientific, but I remember when I was young, I don't remember exactly how old, maybe 4 or 5, that I also felt that I had memories, not from a previous life so much, but of contact with other kinds of beings. And of course, as an adult, I can't distinguish at all whether these are just fantasies of a child But I remember other children of about the same age at the time, they would also talk about what, as an adult, you look at as fantasy creatures. So if reincarnation is true, and there's no reason to believe that the only entities in the universe are on Earth, then I wonder whether some of these stories that, children have are something like a reincarnation, but they're not coming from a human, from something else.
Well, yeah, and you know, the thing is, of course, they can't be verified. I mean, that's the sort of the beauty of our cases, where you actually can verify that, that they were actual memories. But that doesn't mean we should discount them. And we do get reports of young children seeming to talk to angels, or, you know, what's interpreted as angels anyway. But there could also be, I mean, who knows what the world, including the larger consciousness, might contain. So I wouldn't discount those by any means. And in fact, you know, when occasionally in the clinic, we will have parents concerned about such things, and those, you know, we can usually just reassure the parents that it certainly doesn't mean any sort of mental illness thing, but that there are a lot of kids who will talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Our next question will come from Jackson. Jackson, go ahead. You have the mic.
Oh, hello. I find that your report here intriguing. I'm wondering if development of this body of data that you're gathering has increased the tendency for therapists working with adults to go into past lives when that kind of recall becomes available to them.
Well, I mean, it doesn't usually become available to adults unless, again, they do hypnotic regression kind of work. Now, certainly, there are a lot of hypnotic regression therapists who have sort of used Ian's work to support what they're doing, even though Ian was great lengths to say they shouldn't. But, you know, I mean, if you're persuaded by our work that reincarnation does occur, then obviously that opens up the question of how past lives might be used in other ways, including in therapy. But it may be, when people do that sort of work, it may be like people, say, who do dream analysis, where even if it didn't actually happen, it can still be useful to explore on a psychological standpoint.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jackson. And now we'll bring the mic over to Sandy. Sandy, go ahead. You have the mic.
Oh, thanks very much. You were mentioning about how some of the children who are reporting these kind of experiences seem to have a certain amount of psychic ability. I was just wondering, has this ever been followed up on as they've gotten older to see if, even after they're forgetting the reincarnation, do they still have a tendency to be gifted psychically?
Well, that's a very good question that I don't have the answer to, because our focus has been largely on the past life material. So no, we have not explored that in any sort of systematic way. But like the child that I talked about, I will certainly plan to follow him over time, and it will be interesting to see if he sort of leaves all this behind and just gets wrapped up in this world, or if he continues to have some special abilities.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Sandy. All right, the next question will come from Linda. Linda, you have the mic.
Oh, thank you. Dr. Tucker, I'm very glad that you're doing, that you're continuing the work that Ian Stevenson had started. I think it's important work. I had a speculation when I was looking at some of the stories in your book, and I realize it's not provable, but I wonder if you've had any of these thoughts. It seems like a lot of the children who have these memories died what many would consider to be at a premature time. They died when they were fairly young. They had concerns about how their children were doing. And they came back at a time that some people might think is fairly quick, although I have no idea. There's no time on the other side, so that's just a human construct of, you know, of the earth plane. But I wondered if the tendency to remember a past life and to bring birthmarks or physical effects from the other life had something to do with a soul feeling like it's died prematurely and wanting to hurry back to the earth plane. Have you ever thought about that?
Yes, and I mean that's certainly possible. The other possibility is that the soul is not necessarily in control of the process, that they are is more of a naturalistic kind of thing where they come back quickly because they haven't fully detached from this plane anyway because of the way they died or how quickly they died or that there's still an emotional pull that sort of keeps them tied here, so then they are quickly reborn.
The other question I had is just, how is this, it's not a scientific one at all, how has this affected you personally?
Well, I think it has helped make me more open to considering things that I really had not paid much attention to before. As far as, you know, I was going through medical school and all that, certainly it had a kind of Western materialist frame of mind, even though I never rejected religion, even if I wasn't practicing it. But having gotten involved in this work and then through variety of experiences in life, I certainly think it's made me more open to possibilities and also hopefully more appreciative of the experiences that life involves and not just so focused on sort of the material part of things.
Because I find to me hearing, you know, all the various things I've read or experienced that told me that life is so much larger than many people believe, that I just found it so comforting.
Well, I think it can be comforting, yes. And hopefully it also, you know, if we're comforted enough by it, we can become a little less perhaps self-centered and you know, treat each other a little better.
Well, it certainly places life in a different context.
Yeah. Yeah, where we don't sweat the small stuff so much, as they say.
Although if most people don't remember these, and even the children who remember these past lives don't remember them for very long, then it's kind of comforting in a sense. But on the other hand, if you don't remember it, then it's not very useful.
No, but it's comforting to hear about it and to understand if you... I mean, all of this is so intuitively true to me that I don't need the level of proof that other people may need. But I feel much safer and much more comforted in this life to know that there's a much larger context to life than just this life on the earth plane, you know, life's a bitch and then you die, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's right. And even if, I mean, if the memories stay, the idea that, or the awareness, we may continue on after, you know, this body goes. I mean, that certainly can be of comfort to people. And also comfort to people who have lost people that they loved, to think that they have continued on in some form.
Mm-hmm. There's also a flip side, though, which is if life is a bitch and then you die, you have to come back, it's still a bitch.
Well,
in other
right.
words, you know, it's a never-ending...
Yeah,
a wheel,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, so the whole Buddhist idea of trying to get off of that.
Right.
But I think, I mean, there's something to be about that, but I think also this work, I hope, can be life-affirming as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Well, at minimum, it suggests that the present understanding of brain, mind, and consciousness is probably overlooks something very, very important.
Indeed.
Yes. Yeah.
Which shows our fundamental understanding of the world is incomplete or incorrect.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And we're giving the mic now to Connie. Connie, go ahead. You have the mic.
Okay. I'd like to know where a person could go to share past life experiences.
Is it
how
from
to
Jamila?
Connect with other people.
When you say share, you mean tell other people?
Well, to share with other people who have gone through this.
Well, I think it probably online would be the easiest way to share with other people. In fact, there's a woman named Carol Bowman who's written a couple of books about reincarnation. She has a forum. I think it's called childpastlives.org, but the forum is about adult cases as well as child. And so there's sort of a community there where people will share.
Yeah. Oh, can you give me that name again?
Yeah, it's childpathlives.org, or you can Google Carol Bowman, which is B-O-W-M-A-N.
Okay. I'm not catching the first word.
Child?
Something past lives.
Yeah, child, like children, child.
Oh, child. Okay, all right, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Connie. And now we're giving the mic to Edwina. Edwina, you have the mic.
Hi. I wanted to ask, Doctor, I've had three things that have happened to me where I have met three different people over, a span of, say, 25 years. Where I was working, I met these women and I knew them, and they knew me. And so the last two, the first one didn't want to have anything to do with me, I don't know why, but the second two that this happened, I met them, it was the first time I'd ever seen them. They saw me, I saw them, and we immediately just embraced, and the name came to me. One lady, her name was, to me, her name was Loretta. To this day, I don't know what her real name was. But she knew me, and she stood up and she says, I know you. And she came at me and put her arms around me, and I says, I know you too. So I thought at the time, you know, we probably were kids together or something. So I made it a point to meet individually with both these women to discuss where we had lived. And in neither case had we ever met or known each other, because we had never lived in the same towns or the same states. And I have wondered about, why did I know them and why did they know me? But it was a strong attraction, yet we had names for each other, but that's not my name.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Loretta was not her name. And same thing with Earlene Kidd, and she told my secretary one day, she says, I know your boss, I know her real well. So my secretary came in and told me, she said, you know, that woman you hired as a temp, she says she knows you very well. And I said, well, I got a glimpse of her. I said, and yes, I think I do know her. I said, but I don't know from where. So I made it a point to meet with her as well. And neither of us had ever lived in the same state or even in the same town or the same neighborhood, nothing. Where did we know each other from? And it begs the question in my mind, would that have been a past life?
Yeah. Well, you do have to wonder. We have heard other reports from people very similar, where there is a sense of knowing, even though they're pretty clear it wasn't in this life. I mean, you know, it's always hard to, like with the temp, well, is it possible you saw each other in a coffee shop or something? But seems like there are times where there's more to it than that. But there is some sort of, I hate to use the word soul connection, but some sort of sense of familiarity that is quite hard to explain. And, you know, who knows, maybe it does have to do with past lives.
Well, this last lady that I met, she came across the sanctuary to me. With a big smile on her face and her arms wide open, and we just ran to each other. The odd thing is, I didn't know she had cancer, but she just recently passed away of that. We were so close and were such good friends. From the moment we met, and she says, I just know I know you. You must have lived in Utah before. And I says, I've never lived in Utah. And
yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like there's a strong, immediate emotional connection there.
It amazes me, and it kind of makes me uneasy, too, to be the truthful about it. I just can't figure it out. And I thought, well, I know that I've never lived where she lived. But why this tremendous feeling that I do and did know her very well?
Okay, Edwina, thank you. We're going to sneak in one last question that was emailed into us before the top of the hour. And that was emailed to us by Lucy. And the question is, could Dr. Tucker comment on any relationship between suicide and reincarnation?
Well, we do have cases where children reported committing suicide in their previous life. We don't have a huge number of those cases, but we do have some. As far as the relationship goes, it seems that it would not preclude somebody from being reborn. Whether it make it more or less likely, there's no way to say.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, we are at the top of the hour, so I'll now turn the mic over to Dean Radin.
Thank you, Lindsay, and I want to thank our guest once again, Jim Tucker from the University of Virginia. I would encourage everyone to find a copy of his latest book called Life Before Life, A Scientific Investigation of Children's Memories of Previous Lives. And we'll look forward to our next installment of the Essentials of Noetic Sciences. I guess everyone else can stay in line and continue to discuss this, but Jim and I will quietly fade away, and hopefully we'll be reincarnated in another teleseminar.